All right, good morning, everyone. We're going to try and look at some issues in this session having to do with the interface of Orthodox Judaism and mental distress or illness. The issues will become, I think, abundantly clear as we go through the conversation. So with that, no further ado, I'm going to introduce our panelists. To my right, Dr. Michelle Friedman. Dr. Friedman received an MD from the NYU School of Medicine. She's completed advanced training at the Columbia University Psychoanalytic Center for Training and Research. She's also the founder and director of the Pastoral Counseling Program at Yeshivat Chovevei Torah. In addition to her private practice and her role at YCT, Dr. Friedman is assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Next to me, Rabbi Dr. Zvi Hirsch Weinrib, the executive vice president emeritus of the Orthodox Union. He received a smicha from the Rabbi Jacob Joseph Yeshiva in New York, served as spiritual leader of Congregation Shomrei Emunah in Baltimore for 13 years. He has a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Maryland, and he served as a psychotherapist for mental health organizations for many years, while also maintaining a private practice. Please welcome our panelists. Dr. Friedman, you've written that, quote, people come to mental health treatment because they're in pain. The presentations of their pain vary. They come because they suffer from symptoms that restrict or threaten their lives, or because they're struggling with inner conflicts that undermine or torment their integrity, or because if they don't come, they'll lose their job, their spouse, their children, unquote. It seems to me this depicts very accurately why people come for therapy, yet we know that many more do not come, despite suffering greatly, and in the Orthodox community, this seems especially true. I want to ask you to begin with, why do people who need treatment not avail themselves of such treatment? And what do you think is the breaking point, i.e., what would it be that would finally convince them to come for help?
Okay, this is a vast topic, and I try to organize myself kind of around three responses. And I would say that certainly this has changed enormously in the time of my professional life. I would say there's really a sea shift in terms of an awareness and a availability to mental health treatment in all communities. One example that I'll give, which is cross-cultural, across every culture, and that is the attitude towards treatment for postpartum anxiety and depression, which was absolutely not recognized about 30 years ago, and that has vastly changed. And that's in all communities, Jewish, everything else. And as well in the Jewish community, I think there are many, many more. I would say 20 years ago, there were zero panels like this. There were no mental health, Orthodox, Jewish, whatever it was, conferences going on. And then with the rise of Nefesh, which is an Orthodox mental health organization, other kinds of things, there's much, much more awareness of this whole factor in people's lives. But still, treatment for psychiatric distress, for mental illness, remains highly stigmatized. One, I think it just has to be mentioned, is that I would say that mental illness trumps all in terms of negative valence in the shidduch marketplace. And I'm not making fun of this at all. I mean, it's really staggering to me that people can have family histories of very severe medical illnesses, all kinds of other things, but when mental illness is in the picture, that is like the toughest thing to get past. And that's just sort of another way, really, of saying the same thing. Why? You know, why is there such shame and fear? And I really want to underscore the word shame, which I think is probably the most corrosive emotion in community and personal life. So I'm going to talk about a sign that's on the painted on a building near my office. So my office is on 70th and West End in Manhattan. And for those of you, when you come to Manhattan and come to the Upper West Side, get off the subway at 72nd and Broadway. That's 1, 2, or 3, IRT. And you look east on a building painted on the brick, sponsored by one of the national mental health organizations, is a phrase that says, depression is a flaw in chemistry, not character. Depression is a flaw in chemistry, not character. Now, everything that's going on in our lives and our beings, like right now, you know, we're sitting, we're looking, we're listening. Obviously, everything is being modulated, is being communicated by chemistry. You know, our brains are registering, our synapses are firing, you know, whatever it is. So, you know, people say, well, doctor, do I have a chemical imbalance? You know, and they want, so that can be, this whole thing about depression being a flaw in chemistry, not character, can be sort of pushed to an extreme. Nothing's the matter with me. I don't have any inner psychological work to do. You know, give me a pill and that's going to fix it. So there's this like division, you know, between the black box of the psyche and the brain. So it can get pushed in that way. But I would say that coming to our issue of why people don't seek treatment, because they do feel that dysphoric, unhappy, unpleasant mental states, ways of behaving that other people may see as pathologic, addictions, preferences, whatever it is a flaw in their soul. And so to recognize that is to acknowledge that there's something profoundly defective, abnormal, something like that. I'm just going to refer back to my medical school experience. I went from, did my surgery rotation, and then I did psychiatry. And surgery was really very demanding, long hours, this and that, whatever. Psychiatry had much shorter hours, but there was like an exhaustion, like a flattening at the end of the day. And I realized at some point that when I was on surgery, like I knew the patient had the liver tumor, I didn't. The patient had the appendicitis, I didn't. On psychiatry, the patient had depression, had anxiety. Like who of us hasn't had some flicker or bigger episode of that kind of thing? You know, the border between pathology and normal life, or normal, or what we accept as the range of livable normal, when it comes to psychological distress, psychiatry, whatever we're going to call it, is much, much vaguer. And I think because of that, you know, you can look under the microscope and you can see the slide of the liver, tumor or whatever it is. Like that's the bad stuff. And it's not me, but in this other stuff, like, uh-oh. So I think people are scared of getting in close to it. So I think that's one thing. And I also want to bring up, now this is the last thing that I'm going to bring up in this part of my discussion is a little bit of a smaller maybe phenomenon. It affects fewer people, but it's something that I've seen recently, and I do want to bring it up for discussion. Now, as a psychiatrist in New York, and having been around for now like about 33 years in practice, and there aren't that many observant women psychiatrists, so I've seen people from all across the religious spectrum, and really from the very far right, the Hasidic world, the ultra yeshivish world, you know, that the communities in Muncie, New Square, Monroe, Williamsburg, you know, etc., Lakewood. And I think that there is a, as we are more, with the advent of the internet, which is, I think, the biggest changer, you know, in the world as we know it, there's more and more complexity in communities. And I've come across a phenomenon of people, and this is more in the ultra-religious world, who are struggling with some kind of marginalization. Either there, and I really don't like to use this term because I think it sort of demonizes, but they do use it themselves, the OTD world, the off the derech world, who are people who are, you know, grow up in whatever, Samra, Bells, ultra Hasidic, and believe nothing, and also people who are struggling with other kinds of marginalization, whether they're gay or lesbian, whether they don't conform in some way, they can get sent to mental health professionals. Because they want, there's a wish in the community to fix this, to get people back into kind of the mainstream. So I think another resistance, in again, this is in a smaller quarter to seeking mental health, is that something about themselves is going to be pathologized and treated as some kind of, you know, like I said, a pathology that should be rooted out or such.
I just want to pick up on one of the threads you pointed out here. So although the attitudes to psychotherapy and mental health treatment have changed within Orthodoxy, you're pointing out that there are still segments of the community, and it seems like the further right you go, the more that may be the case, where there's stigmatization based on the fear of what happens in terms of the reputation for the whole family, actually it makes that person sound like a sacrifice for the rest of the family, in terms of their shidduch prospects and so on. I wanted to ask Rabbi Weinrib, if this is the case, in other words, if we accept these premises that distrust still prevails, psychotherapy still stigmatized in certain circles, connected to the shidduch problem and so on, what do you think can be done to change that state of affairs?
First of all, I agree very much with Dr. Friedman that the situation has changed a lot. And not only in all circles of the Jewish world, left to right, up to down, there is much more acceptance of therapy. In fact, in some circles, it's become a fashion to seek therapy. And it's not only not detrimental, but it's considered a value. I've been through therapy, and therefore, of course, I'm the paragon of mental health, and you can marry me, et cetera. I've seen that too, which is just a degree to which things have changed. But I think in addressing what can be done to diminish the distrust, which still exists, one has to deal with the expectations that people in general have of psychotherapy, and particularly in the Orthodox community, and the more traditional, I don't like the term left or right, but the more traditional a Jewish person is, the more he's going to have issues in regard to what I'm calling expectations one has of psychotherapy. When a typical frum person is advised to go to the psychotherapy, let's say by his or her rabbi, it's usually, okay, there's something wrong in the family, rebellious teenager, whatever, depressed person, etc. I recommend you go for therapy. The notion in the person's mind is, I'm going to go to this doctor, the shrink, whatever, and he, she is going to fix it. Going to fix it and make everything all better. Or variations on the same theme, he or she is going to give me advice. More likely, he or she is going to tell me what to do. I've got these issues. I'm going to go to a shrink, talk to me a few hours, whatever, and then tell me what to do. That is the expectation. It's somewhat based on the medical model. I'm going to go to a doctor for whatever, I'll fix it. They'll tell me what to do, tell me what to eat, what not to eat, and how often to exercise, et cetera, et cetera. And to some extent, it's based on the rabbinic model, the old rabbinic model. I'll go to the Rav, is it kosher, is it treif? He'll tell me it's treif, and I'll know what to do. And of course, psychotherapy is something very, very different. It's not advice, and even MDs don't practice in the medical model. And certainly those of us who are not MDs. It's a different model entirely. And once the frum person, patient, and especially patient's family, gets a notion of what psychotherapy really is all about, he hears, or she hears, several words that really are threatening to a frum person. And those words are freedom, change, autonomy, etc. These things are highly valued in the liberal democratic society at large, and that's what makes psychotherapy so popular, but they are extremely threatening to an Orthodox person. Freedom, well, that can go anywhere. Autonomy, you're gonna give my 16-year-old a notion that he, she is autonomous? No, they got to listen to me, and they got to follow the certain track. They got to go to this seminary and that yeshiva and wear this color hat, et cetera, et cetera. And the autonomy is very threatening. And change is the most threatening of all. And those conceptions, and they're accurate, because therapy is about autonomy and about change and about freedom, freedom of choices, exploring alternatives, et cetera. Those processes are very threatening to an Orthodox person, and by definition, I mean, orthodoxy is not freedom, it's not change, it's not autonomy, but just by the definition of the words. What to do about that, of course, has to do with what one is can do, leaving the psychotherapy world, about the conflicts that we all face as Orthodox Jews living in a democratic world, becoming increasingly liberal, and the tensions that play out. And there are a variety of options. One is becoming more insulated, one is becoming more assimilated. I don't mean assimilation of intermarriage, I mean assimilating value systems, various kinds of compromises, various kinds of redefinitions of one value or another. It becomes very complex. Dr. Friedman mentioned that one area cross-culturally where people are much more open to psychotherapy is postpartum anxiety or postpartum depression. And that brings me back many years to one of my favorite stories, and it's very telling about the mindset from people in a certain sector of the Orthodox world and the threat of a psychotherapy. I used to practice, I was part of a group practice in Bethesda, Maryland. I'm a PhD, not an MD. In those days, we didn't have any notion, even any dream of having rights to prescribe drugs, to prescribe medications. But the group practice, actually this particular group practice, I was the only non-medical therapist. The others were all psychiatrists. And one of them was a woman, another Dr. Friedman in my life, Dr. Sylvia Friedman is her name, who, by the way, fascinatingly, first time she met me, she says, "My name is Dr. Sylvia Friedman. I am not Jewish." She's not Jewish. So you think Sylvia Friedman, Sylvia is my mother's name, and Friedman is Friedman. But her father was Friedman, her mother was McIntyre, and she's halakhically not Jewish in every other way, many other ways also not Jewish. But she's an expert psychiatrist, and we had a kind of a partnership in many ways. And if I was meeting a patient whom I thought might need medication, so we had a little intercom, and I could tell when she was available, and I would press the button, and she would come into my office and interview the client for a few minutes, and sometimes consult with me, and prescribe the necessary medication, or occasionally even hospitalization, things which I couldn't do. A woman came to me, I'll never forget it, and it was clearly postpartum depression. You didn't have to be a rocket scientist, a diagnostician, to know that. But her ideation was very, very interesting. Because that year, there was a rumor going around, it was a few weeks before Pesach, and the rumor was that two people, a Sfardi and an Ashkenazi, I think it was, Rav Shach and Abu Katzera, they both said Mashiach's coming this Pesach. And whether they said it or not, I don't know, but that was the rumor in the community. They both had dreams, and they both said Mashiach's coming. So her ideation was, well, you know, right now I'm suffering. I got this beautiful little baby, but I'm really very, very depressed, and it has all sorts of consequences for my life, my relationship with my husband, et cetera, et cetera. But Mashiach's coming. You know, 5 or 6 more weeks, Mashiach's coming, it'll all be all over. So what do you do about that? So I called, I buzzed Sylvia, Dr. Friedman, and asked her to please come in for a moment because I felt medication would clearly help cut through some of this depression, and I'd work with the ideation, however I'd work with it. So Sylvia came into the office, and she started to interview the patient, and it became obvious this patient believed that Mashiach is coming. And Mashiach, so Sylvia said, Mashiach, that's the Messiah. Oh, the Messiah is coming. So Sylvia looks at me and says, we have to consult. And she says, you know, my official English name is Howard. She said to me, Howard, we've got something on our hands here. She needs not only medication, but I recommend, you know, suburban hospital is right down the street. I really recommend a short-term hospitalization for her. This is really serious. I mean, she believes the Messiah is coming in a few weeks and all her problems are going to go away, et cetera, et cetera. So I said to Sylvia, no, it's a cultural thing. It's not really a psychosis, nothing near that. You know, there are a lot of people back where I come from, in the ghettos of Baltimore, that believe the same thing at some level. It's not what you think it is. So she looks at me and says, Howard, Do you think the Messiah is coming in 6 weeks? We talk about the connection between psychology and religion. You know, that kind of epitomizes it. By the way, many years ago, she invited me to the marriage of, well, several years ago, the marriage of that postpartum child. And of course, she still thinks this Mashiach is coming this Pesach, or not be this Pesach, it'll be next Pesach, and that's what we all believe. Did he come?
That's what you ask.
That's another religion about the question of did he come or not. For us, he did. Old Loba, he didn't. Hasn't come yet.
Dr. Freeman, you mentioned the notion that if you're sort of religiously off the path, you would go to therapy. I'm wondering the inverse, right? Is one of the challenges for the religiously observant patient the fear that going to therapy will affect your faith once you're inside there? In other words, there's this. And that raises another issue, whether for both of you, when religious patients come, is there a murky line between treating you as the religious advisor or treating you as the therapist? And in a sense, you're indicating they don't quite understand the role that you play.
Can you just restate the question?
Yeah, the question is one of the fears of the Orthodox patient that the therapy process is going to affect their faith, their belief, and maybe that's all grounded in sort of not understanding exactly what goes on in this process when they first come.
I think people do, as Rabbi Weinreb said, those powerful words of freedom, autonomy, and change do so a certain amount of fear in the hearts. I don't know about so much the people who are coming, but maybe the people around them. And I could talk more about that. I have found, and I've treated a number, people are not coming to see me. I'm not a rabbi. I'm a psychiatrist. So they're coming to see me with symptoms and problems in their life. And they bring up that they're afraid that this is going to shake their faith or their practice. My experience has been that clearing up psychological, psychiatric problems actually strengthens faith and practice. Because I think if somebody, for example, to use an off-quoted type of example, if somebody's scrupulosity in preparing for Pesach or preparing for mikveh or putting on tefillin is really much more of an obsessive-compulsive type of thing, and Judaism being highly ritualized can lend itself to expression in that, that becomes a very burdensome, painful experience. If somebody is really worrying, like, oh no, I didn't get that under that last fingernail, I didn't get that counter, it becomes a very negative, painful experience. So I have actually found that in treating psychiatric distress, people have clearer, more whole, more joyous, I would say, experiences of their religious life. It has not been my experience that people fall away because of psychotherapy. That doesn't mean, however, that people don't think, I am holding on to practice because of X, Y, or Z reason, and that as they uncover that, they don't want to necessarily hold on to certain kinds of practices. I mean, there is no question that psychotherapy is a change agent. I do think that Orthodoxy has changed over the millennia, and I think that we are constantly, as humans, in a process of change, and I think sometimes this is a really necessary or positive thing. I've recently had the experience, I was talking about this over Shabbos, of meeting with, for various reasons, people from, this happens to be from the Satmar community, and I was, just last week, sitting across this patient in the consulting room, who is from a very profoundly Satmar community, wearing the whole garb, telling me that he believes absolutely nothing and that he is in this frum and stuck life. There is a growing number of such people in a quote-unquote mixed marriage because his wife is a believer and they have like 7 kids and he's 34 and what's going to happen. And I was thinking, like, what is his expectation? Is it, it's not to restore his faith. It was, I think, to figure out a direction for him to go. How is he going to navigate these rocky shoals of a life that he has a great deal of responsibility and love for, and an internal life that is sort of like a In some ways, he was like a 12-year-old who was kind of starting to question for the first time, but he was obviously in a very, very complicated, highly responsible life. So this kind of leads a little bit to a question that people ask me, and I've written about in Jewish Action, actually. Jerry Loeb was the counterpart person from Chicago who responded to, which is, should your therapist be Orthodox for from people? Because some people feel like, oh, you know, if the therapist is Orthodox, then that's going to make sure that the psychotherapy doesn't go in any kind of dangerous or trespassing outside the bounds directions. And I actually don't think that's true. I think that good therapy should subject anything to the rigor of questioning, and that what is going to stand up to the test of inquiry is going to stand up the test of inquiry. I certainly believe that if somebody, I would not send somebody to a therapist who was disdainful or scornful of religion. I think that would be a negative value that would prejudice that therapy. And obviously, if somebody's more comfortable seeing an Orthodox therapist, I think that's important, because I think it's important for people to feel comfortable with the person they're seeing. But if somebody comes to me and says, you know, this is like what Shabbos feels like, or, oh, I hate going to the mikveh, I'm not going to, because I know what the words mean, I'm not going to like make an assumption, an unspoken assumption, like, yeah, we know what this is about. I'm going to say in plain English, I know what Shabbos and mikveh are, but I want you to explain to me what these experiences are for you, because it's a different, we're not the same person, and it's important for me to understand what your experience is. So I think this goes in, you know, all kinds of directions.
Okay. I mean, Dr. Friedman touched on many, many points. I think I agree with her on all of them, except that I have a different experience, certainly different experience of going to the mikveh, but different experiences in many ways, for many reasons, most of them having to do with the fact that I'm not just an Orthodox person, I'm an Orthodox rabbi.
Right.
And although when I was immersed in the practice of psychotherapy, I was not practicing as a rabbi. But as my wife tells me, you were a rabbi from the time you were two. You know? And it's kind of obvious. I would see patients in my home office, or even in my secular office. I would have Sforim in a bookcase, or even English Judaica on the bookcase, which kind of tipped it off. And different times in my career, I did or didn't wear a yarmulke, but it was always apparent to people that I was, not only to Jewish patients, but to Gentile patients, it was obvious that I was a rabbi. So there was this role confusion in the perception of the patient of, is he a rabbi, clergyman, holy man, or is he a free-thinking psychotherapist? The problem really is not, for me, it was not so much in the perception that the patient had of me, but it was in my own perception of myself. Like, who am I? Right, which is a question we're supposed to have answered by the time you're about 18, but I'm a little older than 18 and still haven't answered that question. Who am I? And it's especially true when you're dealing with a person who has religious issues, and you're seen as a religious person, and I'm not just talking about Jewish religious issues, I've dealt with people of all sorts of faiths and non-faiths. And then I have my own, what's in the field, psychoanalytic language is called counter-transference, you know, toward this person. Sometimes I'm very envious of this person, you know, he, she is really questioning religion, and I have these questions too, but I can't even explicitly express those questions. I wish I could be like that way. Or sometimes, oops, this person is going OTD, off the derech, I better do something to stop it. And then I catch myself and say, no, that's my role, maybe it is my role, etc. So the conflict is in my own head and in my own self-identity, which makes things very, very heavy and existentially extremely important. There's a phrase going around now, it goes around lately every time there's a horrible terror attack, I am Charlie Hebdo. Or we are all Parisians. I think it started with JFK, we are all Berliners. Yeah. Well, one of the things that's helpful is we are all OTD. We are all off the derech. And I've shared that with various people in various contexts. And it rings a bell. The conflicts in the patients that we're seeing, especially we're seeing Orthodox patients, and this is a problem you had in training, because it's not just that they have depression and I get depressed, they have anxiety and I get anxious. It's that they have religious conflicts and so do I, and they have questions and so do I. Only they're acting out in certain ways that aren't open to me because of, quote, who I am. I think this is where the action is when we talk of the issues that that Dr. Malamud raised.
You're talking about blurring lines, so I'm just curious. It's a very broad area, but when people come to see you, what are the sort of criteria, the standards you use to delineate between what you might see as like healthy piety in a patient and maybe more dangerous pathology? There's a book that came out some years ago called Sanity and Sanctity by two psychiatrists, David Greenberg and Eliezer Wisdom. And two of the chapter headings are very telling. One of them is, ritual is psychopathology, or is the code of Jewish law a compulsive's natural habitat? And another title was, is the Torah perfect medicine, or does it cause OCD? So I'm wondering, is there a line between religious, you know, healthy religious expression and pathological behavior, and how do you assess when it's been crossed?
Okay. That book, by the way, is really interesting to read. They're both psychiatrists who practice in Yerushalayim, and their emphasis is a lot. It's on that the ultra-Orthodox community. this has also been talked about by rabbis, Dr. Isidore Twersky, Levitz, and Avram Twersky in their book on rabbinic counseling, and we talk about it in our book next year. But I think that the kind of key rule is, and this might refer to Rabbi Weinreb's patient with the Mashiach question, is what's the cultural norm of the community? And what's the, and the same kind of rubric would be applied to, let's say, a child. You know, what is the expectation, the sort of normative developmental expectation for a child? So, for example, if a child is still wetting his or her bed at 12, we would pretty much say, no, that's not, no, you know, that's not like normal developmental. There's something problematic there. If a kid is 2, it's different. I'll just give you another example, like in terms of the training that I do with the rabbis. So if a parent comes to a rabbi and says, Rabbi, can my child color with crayons on Shabbos? I hope that the rabbi's first question is, how old is the child? Because if the child is 2 or the child is 8, I think the answer is going to be somewhat different. So similarly, I think that we really need to retain a certain common sense and think about what are the cultural expectations of a community and how much does somebody's behavior deviate or, you know, depart from, deviate might seem like a negative kind of word, you know, what those expectations are. So I think the rest sort of speaks for itself, basically. And I'd leave it with that. I think that if we kind of keep coming back to, like in this lady, like you know, my namesake there, whatever, Sylvia Friedman, you know, was right on the money when she said, I'm sorry, what's your given name?
Howard,
do you believe that Mashiach is coming? You know, and you probably like sort of shrug, like, not exactly. Now, I would say it's probably a fairly small group of people that felt the Mashiach was coming that exact Pesach. And perhaps this woman had, I mean, I was kind of wondering if she thought her child was the Mashiach. That's where I was going as you were telling me that story. You know, or was this kind of like a Rosemary's Baby situation? Or like, what was doing here? But I think that, you know, the more narrow and idiosyncratic somebody's behavior is, I think the more concern it's going to generate in the mind of the therapist.
There's something very tricky about what you just said to me, which is if we're only assessing it by a cultural standard, the entire cultural standard could be skewed. If I go into a community where every single person thinks the Messiah is coming in 6 weeks, so if the person comes for therapy and thinks that the Messiah is coming in 6 weeks, my response should be, according to your criteria, well, this is perfectly normal for your culture, but it could still be utterly pathological. Mm-hmm. So to simply assess it by a cultural norm seems...
Okay, so I think that, you know, you don't just take, then I should say something a little bit more, flesh that out a bit more, that you don't take one thing in isolation. You've got to look at a whole spectrum of beliefs and absolutely of How is somebody's lived life going? So let's say this lady, let's stick with the lady with the Mashiach situation going on. What is going on with her eating? What's going on with her sleeping? What's going on with her hygiene? Can she concentrate? What is going on in the basic parameters that anybody in the mental health business is hopefully going to assess? So let's say everybody else in this community thinks Mashiach is coming, and they're doing what I guess you might, be doing. But they're able to live their life, but she's not able to. Let's say these other parameters of what we would consider, normal functioning are really way off. So it's not, you can't take, I want to make two points here. You can't take one piece of behavior or thinking in isolation. And I think another key point in psychological assessment is you can't take one point of time as diagnostic. Now, if in one point of time somebody says, Mashiach is coming and I can, we're going to be able to fly, and so I'm going off this balcony, which is on the 11th floor, that's enough of a one point in time for me to react like emergency-wise. So I'm not saying you got to always wait. One of the things I always stress is assessing urgency. But you can't really make, other than situations of urgency, you can't really make a diagnosis over one point of time, because you need to really get a little bit more sense of what the arc of a history of somebody's presentation. So I do think that having a sense over, when did this start? How long has it been going on? How has it changed? Is incredibly important. And it's very, very helpful to see a person more than once, so you can sort of see the stability, the durability of their presentation. I hope that was clear.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
A few things. First of all, I'm sorry. The book is really a must read, although it's already a little outdated in various ways, both in terms of development of clinical psychiatry and because of the increasingly meshuggah firm world that we live in. But David Greenberg is a psychologist, and Eliezer Wisdom is a psychiatrist, and I've met them both. David Greenberg himself personally is Dati, and Eliezer Wisdom is personally not Dati. And they write about that different perspectives in the book and subsequent publications that they both wrote, or they wrote separately. But I don't recall if it's in that book or if it's in conversation I had with David, who I met a number of times. We used to meet in the Starbucks on the West Side, on Broadway and 70-something Street. To talk when he would be lecturing in the States, we would meet. But the problem that he faced was precisely this. Yes, I can judge this obsessive compulsive or scrupulous behavior in terms of whether it was a norm of the culture or not, but especially in Yerushalayim, Yer HaKodesh, there are cultures and subcultures which the whole culture or subculture is pathological. So within that, and some of these subcultures are quite large. In fact, there's something called the Jerusalem syndrome. I don't know if there's any other city in the whole universe that has a psychiatric syndrome named for it. Stockholm, okay,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You see, well, Stockholm and Jerusalem have various issues between them these days. But the there's something about Yerushalayim. It's not just for Jews, it's for Christians too, and for Muslims too, that triggers all sorts of insanity. So that guideline is very helpful, but again, up until a point, and then you come into the much bigger point, which is really not on our agenda here today at all, and that is the psychotherapist as an agent for social change, mm-hmm. which many, many people in the profession advocate, that we should really be changing, not this individual or that individual, we should be changing the society, and et cetera. But the earlier, Dr. Friedman mentioned something very important, and I'll just give it the technical Hebrew name, and that is the concept of simcha shel mitzvah. What we all sectors of Judaism believe in this as a value, how they define it and what they put into practice is very different. But in my thinking, diagnostically, if a woman, and usually men can be OCDs too, but it plays out on different mitzvos. Mm-hmm. For women, it plays out on Pesach and on preparations for the mikveh. For men, it plays out with tefillin, if it's exactly in the right place, mm-hmm. or with the pronunciation of Lama'an, I'm going to mispronounce it, Lamaan Tizguru in Kriyat Shema. Did I say s or did I say z? And it's easy to get hung up on it. So the way I look at it, there's two ways to discriminate between, is this religiously expected behavior within norms of the culture, or is this pathological? One is, does it interfere with function? Does it interfere with function? If a yeshiva bacha is so hung up on, did I say laman tizkeru or laman tizkeru, that he can't go to the next seder and learn because he just can't stop davening. He's got to make sure he's got it right, and interferes with his function. You know, that's obsessive compulsive disorder. If, you know, he tries like tizguru, then fine, he's satisfied and goes on and functions as he's supposed to, then this becomes this is just, you know, relatively normal. A, B, especially when it comes to Pesach, because my wife Chavi had an ancestor, a great Hasidic Rebbe, Bicheslav Kuzmir. So the traditional Yiddish language, when you want to express good wishes around the time of year, let's say midwinter, and Pesach, Purim, and then Pesach is coming up, so you say in Yiddish, I want you to have Freilich in Purim and a kosher in Pesach. A happy Purim and a kosher Pesach. He used to say, no, I wish you a kosher Purim and a Freilich in Pesach. Because Purim, we tend to get a little carried away and do some things which are not so kosher. And I want to make sure that you observe Purim kosher. Pesach, we get so hung up on being kosher that we forget that the mitzvah of Pesach is not to be kosher, it's to be happy. And if it's going to interfere with your simcha shel mitzvah, if getting an exact burnt piece of crust off the oven is going to make you so frustrated and anger and cause tension in your home, et cetera, and in some cases it make you near suicidal, then obviously that's not simcha shel mitzvah. If you're scrubbing and you realize, yeah, this is hard work, et cetera, but this is part of the preparation for Pesach and I'm so happy about it, that's the ideal of simcha shel mitzvah. I want to share with you another book. When Dr. Malamut mentioned the book by Greenberg and Whitson, Sanctity and Sanity, and Sanity, I forget which is first. What's first, Sanctity or Sanity? Sanity is first, okay. so there's another book that came out about the same time, which anyone in the field who reads Hebrew, especially rabbinic Hebrew, I advise you to read it. It's fascinating. The name of the book is called Eitzot V'Hadrachot, Eitzos V'Hadrachos, Advice and Guidance. And it was put together by, really, in my experience, the first from yeshiva trained person in the United States who pursued and received a PhD in clinical psychology was a man who practiced for a long time. He's now made Aliyah in his old age. In Muncie, whose name was, I think his first name was Yaakov Greenwald. And Dr. Greenwald was a psychologist practicing in the Frum community, and he had various questions about the various issues that we're talking about now, the conflicts between religion and psychotherapy. But he had a relationship with the Stipler. The Stipler was a man, his name was Rav Yisrael Yaakov Kanievsky. He was the father of Rav Chaim Kanievsky, who's considered one of the Gedolei Hador in the Haredi community today. And he was then considered the Gadol Hador. He wrote the Sforim, Kahilas Yaakov, etc. The privilege of meeting him once. So Dr. Greenwald would correspond with the Stipler. Stipler died, I think, in the 1960s, 70s maybe. But
I was at his funeral.
1984. That late? 1984. So in any case, the correspondence took place in the 50s and 60s. And then subsequently, he published some of the correspondence. And one of the questions he asks is, what do you do? Do you ever encounter this obsessive-compulsive behavior in your yeshiva or in your talmidim, that they're so crippled by the tefillin straight or the man tizguru or whatever hang-ups they have? what do you encounter this, Aleph? And Beis, what do you do about it? So the stipler writes back to him. The responses of the stipler are just precious. He writes back to him, yes, I see these people. I see many of them in the yeshiva world. I just tell them, don't worry about it, you're Yotze. It's very interesting. Dr. Greenwald writes back, Rabbi Stipler, you can do that. Mm-hmm. You have the authority, you're sufficient of an authority figure that you can cut through the clinical syndrome of obsessive compulsive disorder. That's the power of your authority because of who you are. I am not Rabbi Greenwald. I am Dr. Greenwald, a psychologist. And if I tell a patient, don't worry about it, the tefillin are okay or whatever, he's just going to ignore me, rebel against me, and probably just look for another therapist. So that's something. But that particular book covers many, many syndromes, sexual obsessions, sexual misbehavior, et cetera, from both points of view. The point of view of a Lithuanian sage, rabbinic sage, and the point of view of a yeshiva-trained, psychoanalytically oriented psychologist.
Let's talk a little bit about kind of triad. I know you referred to it a little bit in your last session. The triad being the patient, the therapist, and the patient's rabbi. There's a friend of mine who's a therapist. He has experience in the religious community, especially with addiction, with drugs, pornography, etc., gambling. And he relayed to me once that in trying to speak to a certain shul rabbi about these behaviors, the rav confidently announced to him that no one in his congregation would have these difficulties. My friend happened to know otherwise because he was actually treating somebody in his congregation. And we were struck by the sort of problematic nature of the rav in denial about his own congregants. And I wonder if either of you have experienced this kind of thing. Is it getting better? You seem to both indicate that people are getting more sophisticated about mental health issues. But do you still have certain frustrations in dealing with certain clergy? And if so, what would you want them to know about the difficulties that some in their community face?
So I'd like to respond to this because I think it is a profound question and problem. And a couple of weeks ago, one of my musmachim called me because somebody in his community, an older person, somebody who was very respected, had a prominent position in a nursing facility, was going to be sentenced. He'd already been convicted of a child sexual molestation charge. And the sentencing was a public matter, and many people in this community were going to know about it, and were really going to be traumatized. So my musmach was calling me to try to figure out how to address this from the pulpit in a way that would be meaningful and helpful to his community. And I said that the biggest issue that you need to help them understand, and I think this is the crux of it, that the fictional or not so fictional rabbi in your story and so many people, congregants as well, have difficulty with, is our great human capacity for compartmentalization. That the same people do good things and they do horrible things. And so when people say, he couldn't have done that. She couldn't have done that. He was so helpful to me when I was sick. He was so good to me, to my ailing parent, to my child who was really confused. He couldn't have done that. And it's very, very difficult. I think we in this psychology business get a little distant. We get so used to hearing really difficult things that we forget that compartmentalization is very active for most people, and it's very, very painful to understand that. It's very difficult in families, for example, when there are really painful situations. I've seen prominent rabbinic families where active situations of incest were going on for years. And how did that happen? How could this be going on? And I think that's really the crux of it, that people can do good things and bad things. I'm not going to say good people do bad things. People do good things and bad things. And we have to really respond. And that leads to the whole thing like, well, if we treat that person, can they re-enter and become members of the community? What is tshuva in this situation? Is tshuva the same as being able to resume activities that put that person in a danger of repeating repeat offense? So these are really complicated questions, but I think the core of it is our struggle with understanding compartmentalization, and that people can be very frum people, or they can be totally secular and are capable of all kinds of behavior.
I think Dr. Friedman touched one very important aspect of the issue. And I was privileged long, long ago to hear a lecture at the New School for Social Research. I received a master's degree way back from Eric Frum, Olav HaShalom. Eric Frum is, from a Jewish perspective as well as from a psychological perspective, fascinating, fascinating person. He was once quite frum. I'm sure you heard the name Franz Rosenzweig, and Franz Rosenzweig suffered from Lou Gehrig's disease and was deteriorating, but becoming more and more observant Jewishly at that stage of his life. And Yom Kippur, toward the end of his life, he wanted to have a minyan. He couldn't leave his bed. So he formed a minyan in his home, and the person who officiated at that davening on Yom Kippur was Eric Frum. But that's a side point, fascinating person from that perspective. But Eric Fromm used to say, people often ask me, how can this, such a person have done something so contradictory to who he is? And I always answer, you can't ask that question about human beings, because all human beings are self-contradictory. We all do things differently. We all are hypocrites in some way or another. That's part of the human condition. That's what makes us human, that we're not there's no such thing as a tzaddik who hasn't sinned, including Moshe Rabbeinu. We all do good things and bad things. It's a very important point to mention, and some people have a lot of trouble understanding that. But the principal who was in total denial of the problems that were in his school, you know, I think there's not just one principal out there who has that, who deludes himself or herself that way. I've had the experience, I'm not going to mention the name of the therapist, who's a specialist, a woman I know who's a specialist in eating disorders. And her whole entire practice at that point in time was of girls who were students in a certain school, a large girls' school in wherever. And yet the principal insisted that they have no problems with eating disorders in that school. And this woman who was with me in the office with him had her whole practice of 20 or 25 young girls who were all from that school and all had suffered from eating disorders. And eating disorders are a lot more apparent to the layman than some others mental disorders. You can see this person is becoming skinnier and skinnier and looks like a skeleton, and here she is in the class and it's affecting her function in all sorts of ways, etc. There's a connection between denial and compartmentalization, but there's, I think, denial has its own dynamic as well.
And can you just lead me through? So you're with the principal. The principal's denied it. It's obvious that this is going on. How do you...
It's interesting because I am not the stipler, but at least people think I have a certain amount of religious authority. And this particular therapist asked me to accompany her because she was going to confront the principal with how can you continue to deny? I can show you my caseload. But she knew that this principal was capable of denying that too. Because he could... Because, quote, excuse me, all the ladies in present, but he would say, she's only a woman. You know, what does she know? She's only A, she's a woman, B, she's a therapist, two strikes against her, and three, she's an attractive woman, that's three strikes against her. But this woman asked me to come with her. So I came with her, and I was able to, using, quote, my authority, by the authority vested in me by his perception of me, to cut through that and to say, look, you got to face up to it. And it was a frontal attack on his denial, which I don't know if it got through all of his psychological defenses, but he reacted in a way that was allowed these global situation to be addressed. But denial, you know, as the joke goes, denial is not just a river in Africa. Denial is extremely powerful human defense, which is, we all use it. And it's just amazing the power of denial. We can apply it to all sorts of things that are going on nowadays. The whole world is in denial about radical Islam. And just denial, even after an explosion or an attack of hundreds of people die in France. Denial is an extremely powerful human defense, and it's not easy to get through, but it's something that you definitely find in the Jewish educational system, a lack of willingness to confront mental issues. You don't have it with eating disorders in girls' schools. Generally speaking, eating disorders are more prevalent among girls. But you also find it about drug use. You can go to schools, yeshivas, in various large cities where there are large Jewish communities, Orthodox communities, and the police will tell you what's going on with drugs, where they're available, who's using it, what kind of issues they've had with negative reactions to drug abuse, et cetera, and the principals will insist it doesn't exist. Just one quick anecdote from my rabbinic experience. There was a, I forget what the abbreviation was, JADA or JASA, a Jewish organization to help deal with addictions. And they wanted to speak in my shul to teenagers.
Jacks,
alcohol and
chemical substances.
It was just starting then in Baltimore. The Jacks, not the drug problem goes back before then. And they wanted to speak to the teenagers. So I said, sure. Come. Our parents started, you know, by us, you know, all my members. They were protesting. They're coming. How can you allow these people? They're going to corrupt our kids. They're going to give kids ideas, put ideas in kids' minds, and blah, blah, blah. We don't have this problem, et cetera. So I said, look, I already invited them to come, and they're professionals, and they're blah, blah, blah. I'll sit in with the kids. All right. So you can send your kid or not send your kid, whatever you wanted. So some kids showed up, some kids didn't show up. The professionals, the drug therapists, anti-drug therapists that were there, knew that this was a political problem in my shul. A lot of parents were resisting this and blah, 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 and I have my hands full with it. So they tried to go real gentle, and they started to talk to these kids in very, very basic terms. And the kids looked at them and said, what are you telling us this for? We know about that and the other thing. We know where you can buy crack and schmack and back and all kinds of things. And the interesting thing is that the drugs were easily available in the kosher supermarket, the Atrium in Baltimore, was all kosher stores, kosher restaurants, et cetera. That's where the peddlers were hanging out, and the kids knew the different grades of drugs, how much this cost, how much that cost, where you get the money from. And it started a whole, opened up a whole kind of a scene. But it takes, the way to combat it, the only way to combat it that I know in practical terms, it takes a lot of powerful pushback. Mm-hmm. It's like you're not going to, you know, you can't soft sell it. You have to confront mm-hmm. people with evidence, tell the horror stories, et cetera, shake them up a little bit, and then move in and do what has to be done.
I mean, along the same lines, if people want to ask questions, they should line up at the mic over there, because I'm going to finish up now. Along the same lines, and maybe this is a good way to end, that communal denial mentality also, of course, reaching its apex in sexual abuse cases, where that mentality of it doesn't happen by us, and the resistance to acknowledging problems in our midst. Dr. Freeman, I want you to comment on whether you think Jewish institutions, shuls, schools, whether there are sufficient policies and protocols in place to protect against such violations, if there are breaches of protocol, and if not, why is there resistance to doing so?
I'm sure that there are not adequate policies and procedures in place. I also want to say that no amount of policies and procedures is going to protect unless a community is united in really looking at this together as something that is a kind of a human issue. There are no fences high enough or any kind of paraphernalia that's going to screen out human behaviors. I think that everybody needs to be mindful and watchful of and accepting that this exists in our midst. And I do believe that there need to be guidelines so that behaviors that are outside of these guidelines can be addressed, and there need to be adequate reporting procedures so that if there's a problem that's detected, who do you go to? People don't know who you go to. People are afraid of being shamed, of being ostracized, of being pariahs, and this has absolutely happened. We all know that. And I really believe that it's just vital. I went to a seminar not so long ago, and a very responsible person brought up, this was in New York State, he asked how many, I think there was something like close to 300 religious day schools of all stripes in New York State at that time, how many required fingerprinting for employees? And the answer at that time, this was maybe 5 years ago, was one. Now, I do think that some kind of background check on people that are hired is a reasonable thing for any kind of Jewish institution to be doing. But it's fairly shocking how that doesn't happen. And of course, one of the problems we addressed yesterday is what happens for people who are offenders, but who are outside of the boundaries of the law. They haven't broken civil law, so they kind of get shipped off to another community. And it's really like, you know, there's all sorts of other issues. What happens to that person's family? What about their reputation? You know, what about their kids? All this kind of thing. But I believe really strongly that that you guys, you know, the congregations, I mean, there's rabbis here too, need to work together in a cooperative way to make your communities and camps and schools and hospitals, nursing homes, all agencies healthy and safe institutions.
Let's open the door.
Right into the crack.
Forget it.
No, no, it just fell apart.
It's not broken.
It fell through the crack.
Fell through the cracks. There you go.
My wife would say, Elliot, this is God telling you to stand. all right, so we're going to open it up to the floor. Go ahead.
I think I will not be wrong if I say that the last decades we are talking much more about this kind of conversations, panels, and going to therapists. While I think when I was a child, I grew up in Israel, and so many survivors from the Holocaust arrived, and you didn't see so many talking about trauma and going to therapists and so on. So what happened to the generation? Are we coming weaker? we need more help because we are not strong anymore.
I mean, you know, that I think that's really a question that people feel like, how come people toughed it out before, and why is it that we have this explosion of talk about trauma, and all that whole PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, thing gets labeled like, you know, a teacher was mean to me in school, I'm traumatized, you know, do you get trauma therapy? So I think that there is a cheapening of some of these labels. At the same time, I know as a fact that many people, people who survived the Holocaust, Israeli soldiers who went through trauma, suffered with unexpressed, unmetabolized pain and symptoms for decades, and that it expressed itself in many terrible and awful ways. So I think while there can be a kind of like, oh, we're all suffering, and I, you know, it's sort of trying to cop a plea in life because of some terrible episode can happen, at the same time, there's always a balance between recognizing really serious pain that people are going through and helping them adequately with that. So I don't think we're necessarily that it's a weakening. I think it's a recognition.
Next.
Hi. I think probably in your practice that you come across people who are having psychological symptoms and you realize it's part of a toxic environment or part of a toxic relationship. Do you ever come across people in the religious community where you just think they are not a match to be staying in this religious community and continuing these rituals? That's the source of the pathology.
I'll go first.
The answer is yes, but the is that last night I mentioned an entirely different context. Our religion, even our Orthodox religion, is not homogeneous. There are all kinds of brands and flavors of Orthodoxy. And all relatively legitimate, even from a very rigid perspective. There's, you know, You can be a chassid, you can be a meznagid, you can daven Ashkenaz, you can daven Sfarad, you can go to a Kalbach minyan, you can go listen to a chazan, et cetera, et cetera. So there's enough diversity, at this point in time especially, there's enough diversity within even the Orthodox community, although nowadays some would restrict that range a little bit, but still, so that if there's someone who I believe, or he believes, she believes, that this is just not for us, there's room to go someplace else. And this is especially true in the difficulties with the OTDs, the Orthoderech individuals within the extreme ultra-Orthodox communities. Because often you'll find that when, you know, if someone in a more modern, I hate these titles, but I just have to use them because it's the only way to abbreviate my remarks. If someone in the modern Orthodox community who used to go to this shul gets a little turned off, he doesn't have to become, throw away the whole religion. He can move here a little bit, to the right, a little bit to the left. There are all sorts of options available. However, when a person is in one of the extreme Haredi communities, he is taught, or she is taught from childbirth, from birth, that it's this way or nothing. That all those people out there, they could be wearing yarmulkes and wearing head coverings and going to the mikveh, and but they're all goyim. And therefore, so he said, the person reacts, well, if I'm not going to wear a shtreimel, I might as well go and eat him because I don't fit. And there's no alternatives that we see. And part of working in therapy with from people at all ends of the spectrum is you have religious issues, et cetera, but you could work them out within, I wouldn't say that as a therapist, but you can work that out within within Orthodoxy or within Judaism in some other way. There's all kinds of ways to express your Judaism, even if your psychological makeup is inconsistent with some of them, it can be consistent with others. And again, speaking as an Orthodox rabbi, there are situations where I encourage people to get involved with other denominations of Judaism or non-denominational expressions of Judaism just so the person should have some Jewishness in his or her life, even though it might not be halachically kosher.
Okay, so we heard good points about denial in the community. For somebody who actually wants to proactively make a difference, what can you say to break through that kind of denial? And on a related note as well, very closely related note, let's say you're talking about like a school, you'd hope that they could change their opinions towards, you know, things like mental health, right? And they come back with, this is a direct conflict of interest because how do we deal with it if like a student comes to us and says they feel that they're homosexual, and we can't condone that behavior, or we can't condone that sentiment. So how do you fight that?
I'm not sure what your question is exactly.
My question is that there are people, and you talked about it in more more traditional communities, who are in denial, or who are fighting that kind of movement of being open to therapy and not stigma, right? But what do you say when you talk to when you try and talk to these people and say like this isn't healthy for the children, and they just don't listen? What do you tell them?
So you're saying how to respond to people who are committed to their denial.
Correct.
That's really very tough. I mean, I think that this kind of touches back on some of the points we were making yesterday. Is like, how do rabbis deal with disappointment when you try to counsel people, give advice? I think it's in the therapeutic business also. And like, how do you sustain some kind of hopefulness and commitment over time in the face of tremendous resistance? And I think you sort of break it down to something that's going to be acceptable to a large enough pool of people that you're going to have some traction. So maybe there's some kind of support, a discussion group. Maybe there's some, I have to say, in this day and age with the internet, the capacity for online support groups is staggering. And I think that a lot of people might prefer to have something that's local and that's visible and that they have some kind of, I don't know, I'm not gonna say jurisdiction, but involvement with, rather than, you could, it's almost like a little bit of a threatening thing. If you don't do this, if you don't help this group of marginalized people, whatever the marginalization is, get together, they're gonna go someplace else. So this is your choice. How much are you going to make space for them to express themselves in a Torah appropriate way, or are you going to make that choice of pushing them out? Now, that's a really tough stand to take, because the person who does that, who puts him or herself in that position, is already getting a lot of unpopularity, because you're encountering those folks that don't want to know about the problem. And I think it really starts with finding, as I think any significant, Rabbi Weinreb mentioned before, you know, what do, role do psychologists, what role do rabbis have in social change? I think it's finding, like, the first person finds that second person, and hopefully there's a third person, and there's some discussion that starts that says, there is a problem, there is a need, and what can we do from there? And I think you've got to start with something that's acceptable enough, but touches on the issue that you care about, and you build from there. And you know that it's going to take some time, and you have ways of supporting each other to sustain your frustration as you work towards a bigger goal.
I would just add that the answer to your question lies less in the field of psychology than in the field of politics.
Yeah.
Which is fine. Politics is not a trife word. And one has to learn how to be a good politician. And to affect the kind of change that you're talking about, you're not going to change the mind of that principal by engaging with him in the short-term psychotherapy. You will if you begin to look for allies who think the way you think. That's step one in politics. The allies will probably mostly come from people your age or your gender or your role, other parents, other young people, other whatever. But then you'll find other allies in other groups, and you have to build that system, and then there are other steps in the process. But it's a political process, and politics is dirty, but politics is tough, and politics involves money, funding, sources of funding, influence over the funding, control over the funding, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to affect that kind of political change, you got to play hardball. And so what? You're allowed to play hardball. Baseball players play hardball all the time and get millions of dollars for doing it. More even than West Side Shrinks.
On that note, please give our speakers a warm hand. Thank you.